Let's kind of bring together 11 and 12 real quick because it is tied together. So last week, Jesus received a message that his very good friend Lazarus was very sick. Jesus was down in the Jordan River area near Jericho. So it's about 20 miles away. But the elevation height, because it's either all downhill from Jerusalem or it's all uphill from Jericho, about 3,300 foot difference in elevation. So he's down there. He's enjoying some R&R. It's a beautiful location. He's spending time ministering with no stress whatsoever because all of the religious leaders that create the stress for Jesus are up in Jerusalem. So Martha and Mary, Lazarus' sisters, send a message to Jesus to come and help Lazarus, that he's sick and that he needs his help. So Jesus purposely waits two more days before he heads out. So he waits, literally, he already knew from the time the messenger left, probably within an hour or so of this all-day walk, Lazarus had already died. Jesus knew that he was dead, and he even told that to his disciples. Lazarus is dead. But he waits until he's really dead. So just, you know, as we talked, you know, there were times when Jesus raised someone from the dead within hours, and so some probably were saying, well, he might not have been really dead. They might have been only mostly dead, for those of you that remember that movie. So he waits till Lazarus is really dead. He's actually decomposing already. He's already in the tomb. It's already happening. By the time Jesus gets there, as he heads up, you know, 20 miles uphill to Bethany where these girls lived, and by the time he gets there, Lazarus has been dead 4 days. So he is really dead. There will be no denying that. So Jesus is fully aware of the situation. He's in complete control, and he's going to use this situation to give undeniable proof that he is the Messiah, the Son of God. He intends on raising Lazarus from the dead. Not only just raising him from the dead, but literally, you know, removing the effects of decomposition and all of that kind of stuff. He will bring Lazarus back. So before he gets to that place, he has an encounter with Martha and another encounter with Mary. And he wants them to understand and to truly believe that he is the Messiah. Before he goes and raises Lazarus, he gives them a little bit of a heads up. He looks into the eyes of a broken-hearted Martha, and he spoke those eternal words that we saw in verses 24 of 11, chapter 11, 24, when he said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, though he may die, he shall live. And whoever lives and believes in me shall never die. And then he looks at her and says, do you believe this? And of course, Martha responds with the words that every person, no matter where you live, no matter what culture you're from, no matter what economic place you're at, every person must utter these words in order to be saved. She said, yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who has come into the world. So she knows Jesus is the Messiah. Jesus then goes and he does the impossible. He restores Lazarus back to life, calls him out of the tomb of death and decay, and everyone around begins to believe, wow, this guy is the Messiah. You know, a couple of things that I will share with you. Since last week, you know, there's the shortest verse in the Bible, Jesus wept. And I shared with you some of the ideas that what I could see that why Jesus would cry. I'm going to add another one. Then I'm going to share one that Bill Hardy and I had a little conversation, and he shared one with me that I thought, you know what, that's a very good possibility. But as we get into chapter 12, I wonder if Jesus wept because he knew, even though this was going to bring glory to himself, he knew that this was going to create believers out of many non-believers, but it was also going to put a big bullseye on Lazarus's back. He is now going to become a wanted man, as we're going to find out. So I wonder if Jesus looked at that and said, Lazarus, I hate to do this to you. I'm going to raise you from the dead, but by doing so, you're going to be a target just like I am. It's possible. We'll share the other one with you here when we get to it in just a minute. So many things we learned from the story. You know, Jesus has his own divine timing. Sometimes he will wait until he can do what will bring the most glory to himself. Then he moves, then he acts so that people will become believers. Plus, he also wants us to trust him. So sometimes he waits for us to die to ourselves, to die to our ambitions, to die to any human effort that we may want to throw into the mix to try to fix ourselves or to fix problems. He waits until it's completely hopeless, we are completely helpless, then he comes in, and that's when we look at that and say, wow, there is no way I could have done that. That has to be a God thing. And so Jesus is about that, and we learn to trust him. So amazingly, as you know, we look at these few things that are just, you know, highlighting from last week. If you weren't here, you may want to get the CD or you can listen to it online. This creates a huge stir back in Jerusalem. It's only a couple miles. Bethany's only a couple miles. So some of the people that saw this event, they beeline back over to Jerusalem and they start telling the priests and some of the religious leaders. So these guys now are not happy that Jesus keeps doing miracles. Isn't that crazy? Stop doing miracles. People are believing in you. I mean, what hypocrisy do they have? So he's gathering a crowd of people who now believe that he is the Messiah, which will come into our next Sunday study. And so they know, we got to kill this guy. We need to put him to death. That's the only way to silence his message. The only way we can win this thing is by putting him to death. So here's what their plot is. Here's their plan, as we discovered it at the end of chapter 11. Well, he's been coming up to the feasts. The Passover's just around the corner. Maybe he'll show up at the Passover. When he does, that's our chance to nab him and we'll kill him that time. Little do they know, that's exactly the plan of God. That's exactly what God is planning to do. He's going to use the Passover because Jesus is the Passover lamb. So it's not their plan, it's God's plan, and they've just played right into it. Some beautiful picture when we see this. So Jesus hangs out in the area of Bethany, but kind of undercover, so to speak. He's hanging out in some of the outskirt areas of that city. And probably it's there that Jesus begins to really pour into the life of his disciples. He knows he's only got a short time left. So he's pouring into their life because I can tell you right now, after the Lazarus incident, I bet you they're listening a whole lot more now. So, you know, he hangs out in Jerusalem, and as he is hanging, or excuse me, next to Jerusalem, but as he is, Jerusalem is starting to fill with the huge crowds that will come to one of the mandatory feasts, which is Passover. People will come from literally all over the Middle East, all over the area. They will come to Jerusalem. It was required that every Jewish male show up for that one. And what's fascinating, as we learned at the end of chapter 11, Jesus, rather than the Passover, Jesus was the main topic of discussion. And that kind of brings us here. So in John 12, let me give you a little heads up, okay? In John 12, he breaks up John 12 into three distinct events in the final days of Jesus' life. The first one that we're going to talk about today is his dinner in Bethany with Mary, Martha, and the now living Lazarus. The next thing that you will see is the triumphant entry. Palm Sunday is what we call it. The triumphant entry into Jerusalem. Then the final section that we will see is where Jesus has a discussion with the Greeks. And so we'll break these up. We're going to take these one at a time because I think they're very, very powerful to look at, especially knowing we're heading into the last days or last weeks of Jesus' life. So let's take a look at the first event that we get into, which is his dinner and in Bethany. So chapter 12, verse 1. So then, 6 days before the Passover. So now we move forward from him hanging out in the country, hanging out in the area, people going, starting to come to Passover, Jesus kind of incognito for a season of time. Now we're suddenly brought to the 6 days right before the Passover. Jesus came into Bethany, where Lazarus was, who had been dead, whom he raised from the dead. So Lazarus not dead anymore. There they made him a supper. And Martha served, but Lazarus was one of those who sat at the table with him. Then Mary took a pound of very costly oil of spikenard. She anointed the feet of Jesus and wiped his feet with her hair. And the house was filled with the fragrance of the oil. But one of his disciples, Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, who would betray him, said, "Why was this fragrant oil not sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor?" Now, John tells us a little bit, you can almost sense a little sarcasm in his voice. This he said not because he cared for the poor, but because he was a thief and he had money, he had the money box, and he used to take what was put into it. But Jesus said, "You leave her alone. She has kept this for my burial, for the day of my burial. For the poor you have with you always, but me you do not have always." Now, a great many of the Jews knew that he was there, and they came, not for Jesus' sake only, but that they might also see Lazarus. But the chief priests plotted to put Lazarus to death also. So the dude died, and we got to kill him again. Sad indictment on their hardened hearts. So did Jesus know that, and that's why maybe he said, "Laz, I hate to put you through this, but..." So on account of him, Lazarus, many of the Jews went away and believed in him. So Lazarus was creating believers because they think, "I know that guy died. I came to his memorial service. And now I see him walking around. I watched him put him in the tomb. Now here he is." So 6 days, we are now in what is called the Passion Week, the final week of the life of Jesus. So 6 days before the Passover, Jesus surfaces publicly again. So he comes out in public. He returns back to the area of Bethany because he had been kind of hanging out in some of the outskirt areas of Bethany. He returns to that area because he has some very close friends there. So Martha and Mary and the once dead but now living friend Lazarus live there. But we also meet a new guy here. In this particular city, there was a guy named Simon the leper. So that's where he's going to eat dinner at, is at Simon the leper's house. Now, we learned that from reading the other Gospels, Matthew 26, if you'd like to write that down. If you don't have a study Bible, it already gives you those. Matthew 26, 6 and Mark 14, 3. Put those there next to chapter 12, verse 1. So I can probably say it was a former leper that Jesus had already healed this guy, or else he wouldn't be going to his house. So as the hospitality was of that particular culture, whenever a rabbi would show up or whenever a visitor would show up or a guest, they would, you know, put together a dinner. They would, you know, prepare something. So this one is prepared, as I said, at Simon's house. And so since we have this recorded in three different locations, I'm going to kind of put them all together to give us a more accurate rendition of the whole story. So know this, first of all, this is a very happy occasion. Whenever a guest comes to dinner in that culture, especially one of, you know, Jesus's actually celebrity at this particular time, you know, they're pretty happy. So, you know, in the story of the life of Jesus, what we do see and what we pick out from this particular section, Jesus loved to eat. Have you figured that out yet? I mean, even after he raises from the dead, he makes some sort of a fish breakfast. Now, I'm not into that, but when we were in Israel, we had many of our people, because I'd walk by the, you know, they literally put whole fishes out there for breakfast, you know, in the buffets that we would go to. And I would say, "Okay, it's not the way I want to begin my day," you know, that, you know, you kind of know something fishy's going on. But we did have many people that really enjoy that. Cool. But what I see here is Jesus loved to eat. So here's another occasion where Jesus shows up and is eating dinner with people. You know, personally, I relate to that. I enjoy that. It's good for me. So I love this particular setting also, and we can learn a ton by it. Mary is once again where? At the feet of Jesus. Martha is doing what? She's serving once again. So we see these two sisters that have different gifts and different hearts, and yet we find some interesting things here. Something that Martha will do, she will be serving till the very end. Mary will kind of be at the feet of Jesus. This will be one of the last times. And so it's not the first time that we see either one of these girls doing this. So in the book of Luke, we find a previous occasion. She was at, Jesus was at their house, Martha serving, and this time she got all bent out of shape. She got a little upset. So jot this down, Luke 10:38. Jesus and his disciples continued on their way to Jerusalem. They came to a certain village where a woman named Martha welcomed them into her home. Her sister Mary sat at the Lord's feet, listening to what he taught. But Martha was distracted by the big dinner that she was preparing. She came to Jesus and she said, "Lord, doesn't it seem unfair to you that my sister just sits here while I do all the work? Tell her to come and help me." Jesus said to her, "My dear Martha, you're worried. You're upset over all the little details. There is only one thing worth being concerned about, and Mary has discovered it, and I will not take her away from it." So Chuck talked about this in our devos this past week. It was one of our, at least in the context of one of our devotions out of Chuck's devotions. So here, oftentimes, many people kind of chastise Martha for being a servant. Honestly, I don't think that's the secret she discovered. I don't think that she discovered that maybe I need to be the one sitting at Jesus' feet. Ah, that's what I should do. Because we don't see her doing that, do we? Even here. So this time, she's at a different dinner, not at her own house. She's at Simon's house. The last time, it was a small, intimate group. This time, all the disciples are there, plus Mary, Martha, Lazarus, plus the people that live in the house, so it's a much bigger deal. And this time, I want you to notice what we don't see Martha doing. First time, we saw her complaining. This time, we don't see her complaining. Did you notice that? This time, she doesn't say, "Here we go again. I'm serving. She's sitting at your feet. What's the deal here?" She does not complain this time. So I propose to you an idea. I wonder if from that previous encounter, she learned the secret that Jesus was referring to. She learned it. Was it that Mary's position was more important, more valuable than her position? I don't think so. Because honestly, we need people that are willing to do the serving, don't we? We need people that have the worshiper's heart. And we need people that are willing to actually get out there and do the work of ministry. So here's what I believe she discovered. Write this down in that particular section somewhere. Ecclesiastes 9:10. Ecclesiastes, you can just abbreviate ECCL, 9:10. Listen to what it says. From Solomon, the wisest man in the world. "Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might." Whatever your hand finds to do it with all of your might. Later on, Paul would take that particular principle. He would glean from that particular verse that principle that Solomon laid out, and he would lay it out in the book of Colossians 3:17, where he would say this, "Whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God the Father through him." Whatever you do it as unto the Lord. You give it to him. You do it as unto him. You give thanks to God the Father through him. So, what I propose to you is this. Did Martha learn that for her, serving was her worship? It was her method. It was her flavor. It was her style of worshiping the Lord. Where Mary's flavor, her style, was at the feet of Jesus. Did Martha learn, wow, you know what? I worship the Lord by grabbing him a plate of lasagna. That's the way I worship him. I worship him by taking his plate. I worship him by getting his dessert. Maybe that's what she learned. Because if not, because what Jesus chastised her for was not that she was serving, but that she was distracted by it. So not that she was serving, he didn't say, well, listen, Martha, if you would really want to show your worship, you'd be at my feet also. Notice he doesn't tell her to do that. He kind of gets onto her case a little bit by saying, you're distracted, man. You're distracted by so many of these little details. So did she learn her serving was her worship of Jesus? Because if not, if we don't find that way that God designed us, that personality that he gave to us, if we don't find what that is and then do that as unto the Lord and not worry about who's doing what, don't worry about what anyone else is saying, but just say, I am doing this as unto the Lord. If we don't, we will become distracted and we will then start to look at what other people are doing or what they're not doing, and that becomes a distraction. So listen, let me show you in many other ways where this can happen. If we are people that say, I pray, I'm an intercessor, I love to have the little list that I can have that I can be praying for people, because that's the way I worship the Lord, I love to do that. But then we start saying, well, how many other people are praying like I am? And we start to become critical of those that aren't doing what we're doing. Distraction. What if we, you know, look at, you know, serving as she did? Or what about, you know, worshiping? What about, you know, the fact that we, well, I got rid of my TV. That's my worship of the Lord. Oh, you haven't done that. So you still watch the Olympics. I see. Well, someday when you're more spiritual, you'll understand you need to dump that thing. Mari and I were very involved when our kids were younger in the whole homeschooling thing. And listen, I'm not here to chastise homeschoolers. But what I did begin to notice is that some, not all, but some would look down upon those that weren't. So they say, I can't believe these people are putting their kids into Satan's classroom. And yet some parents have prayerfully considered what to do with their kids, and they were putting their kids in the public school as unto the Lord. Some people were putting their kids and homeschooling their kids as unto the Lord. But when the non-homeschoolers start looking at the homeschoolers, or the homeschoolers start looking at the non-homeschoolers, and they start thinking, why are you doing what you're doing? Don't you care about your children? Distraction. Do you see what Jesus was trying to focus in on here? We are to do what we do as unto the Lord. We answer to him, him only. And don't look around to see if anybody's doing what you're doing or not doing what you're doing, because the moment you do that, you're distracted. Instead of focusing on the Lord, you're focused on other people. And I think that's what Jesus was challenging Martha in. So while Martha is worshiping this particular time by serving Jesus, Mary will worship as she is designed to do at the feet of Jesus. Now, she has been there at other times as well. So think about this, when her life was crushed by the death of her brother, she was at the feet of Jesus. When he came walking up, she fell at his feet. When times were good, in the Luke chapter that I just read for you, she was at the feet of Jesus. And now, here she is again. I'm going to throw a couple of things at you to ponder. Did she know this will be the last time that she will get to worship at the feet of Jesus? I wonder. Personally, I think she knew. I personally think she did. I think she knew what even his own goofball disciples didn't know. This is it. So Bill and I, as we talked last Sunday, he was wondering if Jesus wept because he knew, he looks at their broken heart at Lazarus, and he sees how painful his death was. And yet Jesus knew that in a not so distant future, within a matter of a month, they would have their hearts broken once again at the death of Jesus. I think there's truth in that one also. And there may be many more that we haven't thought of. So it's amazing that what this idea of Mary worshiping, this time Martha's worshiping, she's not saying nothing. She's going, nope, I'm doing this as unto the Lord. I'm not chastising my sister again. I hope that she wasn't saying, okay, silently. I'm not going to say anything out loud because last time I got in trouble. So this time I'm just going to silently do this, but my sister's a loser because she's not helping me. I hope that's not the case. I don't think so. So this time, Mary, we get focus on her for this particular story. Mary decides to do something, and I believe it was her motivation, knowing this is it for Jesus. Knowing, maybe she heard him say it at some point, that I'm going to be the Passover lamb. I'm not sure. But it motivates her to do something crazy, to do something unthinkable for a woman in that particular culture. So let's kind of talk about what it is. Mary comes in to Jesus with perfume that becomes a sacred sacrifice to her. Matthew and Mark decided not to name her as the person that did it. They left her unnamed. John tells us that it is Mary, the sister of Martha. So Jesus is leaning on the table at supper. So in the Hebrew culture, for many of you that may not know, they didn't sit at a table like we do. When you had a big dinner like this one was, they had tables that are literally maybe about a foot, 18 inches off the ground. So the table would be sitting low. So they would then put pillows all the way around this table. Oftentimes they would set these tables up in a horseshoe shape. So really, if you want an idea of what the Last Supper looked like, Michelangelo, is that who painted that one? Totally wrong, totally off. First of all, they have him sitting up. Secondly, they show him eating fish. No fish at a Passover meal, okay? And so it's completely wrong. So let me share with you what would be the accurate way. So this table would be set up like a horseshoe so that way the people serving would be able to come into the horseshoe area, because everyone that was sitting or lying at the table, their feet would go away from the table. So they would lean, put the pillow underneath their arm, lean right up next to the table, feet out beside them, laying on the floor. So then they would bring the plates full of food and set it right there. And really and truly, you guys, we probably should think about bringing this back in. Because here now they're laying there, and the plate is like right there. So they were able to take the food, and whether if they use utensils or if they just use their hand, they would be able to just move it from point A to point B in a real smooth fashion. You know, it'd be almost like, you know, taking your bowl at the end and doing this, but you could just tip it over and say, and bring it on in. So you're very relaxed, you're hanging out, so the feet would be away from you. Because if not, the story of Mary here, she would literally have to crawl under a table to get to Jesus' feet. Awkward. But in this particular case, his feet are readily available. They're behind him. So she's able to come to the outside edge of this table. Do you guys have that picture in your mind? You got it? Did I explain it good enough? Okay. So she, you know, Jesus is just minding his own business, and then something happens to Mary. She's a part of this dinner. She was invited to this dinner. Suddenly, Mary does something totally out of the ordinary. And I personally believe that the Spirit of God, the Holy Spirit, fills her heart with so much love. She has an understanding, I believe, that this is it. He's headed towards the Passover. This might be one of the last chances I get to do this. God moves upon her heart. She can't contain it. She has to depart from Simon's house and run home. So everybody's probably going, what happened to Mary? I don't know. She just ran. She just left here. Well, where'd she go? I don't know. All of a sudden, Mary shows back up upon the scene. And it's almost as if God the Father says, I want to bless my son today. Today, I want to bless him. And Mary, I'm going to use you to do it. I'm going to use you. And you're going to bless him, but in all reality, you're going to receive the greater blessing, because from this particular point forward, everyone will know and remember what you did today. Have you guys found out that's true oftentimes? Have you ever gone somewhere thinking, I'm just going to go and be a blessing to these people? I just want to go. When we go down to Camp Pendleton, we just want to go bless these guys. And we come home a basket case because we got blessed far more than probably what we gave to these guys. You send these gift packages to these kids that are in Afghanistan or Iraq or wherever they may be. And after you put it in the mail, there's this, wow, I just want to bless them. But man, I've been blessed far beyond my wildest dreams. It happens. So this had to be an act of spontaneous, loving worship. She didn't come there planning on doing this, because we know that because she didn't even bring a towel to wipe his feet after she was done. She didn't bring anything to wipe off the feet of Jesus. Instead, she walks up, drops to her knees where Jesus' feet would be, in front of everyone, drops to her knees, takes this alabaster jar full of very expensive oil. Now, what would happen is, this would become a dowry. This was a big deal back then. Honestly, that's another thing that I think, for those of us that have sons that we needed to marry off, I think it's a good idea to bring back in. So this jar is alabaster, so once they put the oil in it, it's sealed shut. The only way to get the oil out, you can't just like unscrew the top. It had to be broken. It was made to set aside. It would be a gift from a father to his daughter, saying, you hang on to this. We're going to put this kind of like, some of the girls that used to. I don't know if that's still in fashion. The hope chest that they would store up stuff there for their wedding day. Only this is different. It would be something you would put away, and it was very valuable. One of the other gospels tells us that it was about a year's wages. So a dad would buy this, and it would take him years to pay it off. But then when it was time for his daughter to get married, she would take that, give it to her husband's family to be, and oftentimes they would take that, and that would be used to purchase their own home or to do the addition on their father's home or to pay for the wedding itself. So very, very expensive. Think about it, a year's wages in our current culture. We'll shoot low. We'll say $20,000. Can you imagine buying a jar of oil that's worth $20,000? Pretty crazy. So, she walks up, takes this alabaster flask, $20,000, alabaster jar, and she has to break it to get it open. So she breaks off the top. You can imagine the sound. Psh! And everybody goes, what was that? And there's Mary sitting at the feet of Jesus. She's weeping. She's crying. She doesn't say a word. She just selflessly pours it. We are told one gospel account records that she put it on his head, another one on his feet, so we're going to say put it on his head and his feet. She anoints Jesus with this very fragrant oil. She pours out the most precious gift that she has, her dowry. She pours it out as an act of her worship. Martha's serving her worship. Mary says, I want to do something completely different this time. So with no complaining, no consideration of the cost, she doesn't go, oh, this is $20,000. No, I'm not ready to do it. She just goes for it. She comes walking in. She knew what she was going to do from the time she left the house and comes back with no idea, no consideration of the cost, a heart touched by Jesus, and an attitude that she said, I want to bless you. I'm going to do this as unto you. Filled with love, she starts to pour it out on Jesus' feet. Now listen, she wasn't buttering him up for something. She wasn't trying to get something from him. She just simply wanted to bless Jesus. I want to bless him. I want to do this. So she comes to the feet of Jesus. Understand, in that culture, to kneel down at a dinner like this was taking the place of a slave. So Mary takes the place of a slave. Listen, Jewish culture, the hair was always put together. They would let it grow. They never cut their hair because it was literally a sign or an evidence. The Bible tells us it's the glory of the woman. Her hair is the glory of the woman. So they would let their hair grow long, but they would always take it, wrap it up, and put it in kind of, up They would make a bun out of it, I guess we would call it, right? They would tie it up. So, something a Jewish woman would never, ever do in public, prostitutes did, but a Jewish woman who was of decency and respect would never undo their hair in public. That's how you would identify the prostitutes, not only by the things that they wore, but by the fact they let their hair down. So she does something that no Jewish woman did in public. She humbles herself, she lays aside her glory, and she sits at the feet of Jesus. Now, what's radical in this particular place that I would share with you, actually, I'll wait for a moment. First of all, notice this. She is silent, and Jesus was silent. Did you notice that? Jesus doesn't say anything. He lets it happen. So he didn't look at Mary and say, what do you think you're doing? He doesn't look at her and say, this is awkward here. He doesn't say, I'm trying to eat, Mary, and you're pouring oil on my head. You know, you could ruin my food. He doesn't say, Mary, hey, do you realize how much that jar of oil costs? Jesus doesn't say a word to her. Those are all things that I wrote down because those are probably the things I would have said, but not Jesus. He doesn't even look at her and say, okay, Mary, what do you want? What are you after? I know you're up to something. What is it you want me to do? Jesus doesn't respond at all. Instead, I believe Jesus looked at her heart. Jesus told them in great detail on many occasions that he was going to be crucified. Third day, he would rise up. Jesus told them on several occasions, I'm going to make it to Passover. I'm the Passover lamb that takes away the sin of the world. John the Baptist said those words. I honestly believe that somewhere along the line, Mary got it. She understood what was happening here. So Jesus looks at her. He sees what's going on in her heart. He sees the pouring out of this very, very expensive oil. But he looks at it as not just her anointing him, but he says, wow, that's what worship really looks like. That's what worship looks like. A heart of love. So understand, guys, this was her dowry. She has now taken that which she would be able to give to the man that would become her husband. What did she just lose? The ability to give that to a man that she would marry someday. She now has no dowry to offer to someone. So in all reality, she just sacrificed her future marriage. That's a radical thing to think about. So she puts her future on the line by saying no. I mean, I wonder, too, why didn't she use it for Lazarus, her own brother? She still has it even after Lazarus is dead. Why? Because this was something she would give to a husband. Now that part of her life is changed. That part of her life is over. She doesn't have that to offer to her future husband. And as she realizes, as she's pouring this out, she kind of is thinking, uh-oh, when I ran and got this jar of oil, I forgot to grab a towel. Pulls out the stick or whatever it was that was holding her hair. She lets down her hair, humbling herself, being vulnerable in that particular moment, and she begins to wipe his feet with her hair. So a couple of things would take place in that moment. In that moment, the oil that she just poured onto the feet of Jesus as she was massaging it, she's starting to take on the same fragrance that Jesus now has. As she takes her hair and she begins to wipe her hair in this oily substance on the feet of Jesus, her hair now takes on the fragrance that is now on Jesus. So in all reality, for this moment of time, the two of them have the same fragrance. Jesus, about ready to give of himself, putting his life on the line, humbling himself, taking the form of a slave, if you will, Mary's doing the same thing, and the two of them have the same fragrance for this moment of time. She smells like Jesus. What a radical thing. So then we are also told that the whole house takes on that fragrance. As you can imagine, you know, if you pour oil into one of those little burner things, and your whole house will begin to smell. That's exactly what takes place right here. Everyone in the house could smell the fragrance. Everyone in the house could see what was going on. They could smell the beauty of what she was doing in that particular moment. How radical to think about. So, unfortunately, and I would say, of course, probably, she was misunderstood and she is criticized. But I'll tell you guys something. From me to you, that usually happens when someone decides to worship Jesus by saying, I want to give him the best that I have to offer. Usually when a person makes that decision to say, I'm going to do this as unto the Lord. I'm going to serve as unto the Lord. I'm going to take care of my children as unto the Lord. I'm going to worship as unto the Lord. Whenever someone, their heart changes in that fashion, there's a whole other group that looks at that with a critical eye. I'll show you what that is in just a minute. So Jesus has said nothing. Mary has said nothing. But then all of a sudden, the silence is broken. But who breaks the silence? Judas. The boys. The boys have to get involved in this. You saw right there, you know, Judas, you know, said, why was this fragrant oil not sold for 300 denarii and give to the poor? It's almost like you want to say, Judas, who asked you for your opinion? I don't recall asking you. You know, I would have probably said, Judas, shut up. It's hers to do with what she wants to do. She put it on Jesus' head. Leave her alone. Now you guys know why I'm not an apostle, right? Now you guys know that, all right? They watched the whole event take place. They're watching this, looking at Mary, looking at Jesus, going, aren't you going to say something? This girl's touching you right here in public. Rabbis don't let women touch them like this. What are you doing? You need to stop this. So Judas pops off, but it appears that the rest of the guys, you know, if you read the other gospel accounts, it's like, you know, they chide in with Judas. So why did the rest of the guys look upon this act critically? I mean, we are reading it from this side of this particular story. But at that particular moment, the one primary thing that, by the things that they said that we can learn, they did not see this act of worship as necessary. They looked at it and said, unnecessary, 20 grand down the tubes right there. They thought, this is ridiculous. They felt that Mary's sacrifice should have been used in some other way. So the unspoken message that they just sent, and you guys know we send each other unspoken messages all the time, right? Sometimes it's by what we say. We think there's something going on behind what we just said. Has that ever happened to you? Where somebody says something to you, I was only kidding. And you go, yeah, right, you were only kidding. You meant it. Admit it, you know. Or people say something mean or they say something cruel and without thinking. That happens also all the time. Plus we give nonverbals all the time to each other. You know, I mean, especially, I know I pick on you girls because you guys are the queens of the nonverbal. And so, you know, the unspoken message here that they did say, why wasn't this used in some other fashion? We could have used that money to feed the poor. Jesus, you're not worth 20 grand. That's the message, isn't it? Your life, this sacrifice, Jesus, you're not worth what she just did. That's too expensive. That was too crazy. That was too great. You're not worth it. That's the hidden message. It's a good thing I'm not Jesus, you guys, because that would have been the end of it. Right there, I would have taken care of that business very, you know, clearly. But now we know that on one side, we smell the fragrance of this spikenard oil. Jesus has it on him. Mary has it on her. The fragrance of true, genuine, heartfelt worship of Mary and Martha. And now we smell the stinky attitude of the disciple. They, too, do not value worship. And one of the indicators of a wrong heart, you can tell it. I'm warning you. I share with you my personal observations. When people begin to criticize worship, or the method, or the style, or the gift, it's the first indication that their heart is wrong. It's the first indication we got a problem with the heart. So, it's time for Jesus to speak. But I want you to notice who he spoke to. Did you catch it? Not to Mary. He looks at the boys, in particular Judas. And I can imagine he probably said, "Hey, Jude." The stuff comes to me, okay? You leave her alone. And he tells her, she understands, this is why I believe that she truly did. She understands what's going on. Her act of worship is in reality preparation for what I'm about ready to do. I'm about ready to give my life. Obviously, you knuckleheads don't get this. She does. So leave her alone. In fact, I'm going to tell you this. This act of worship, this understanding of what she had just done, it will forever be tagged to her name. What a cool memorial for her, don't you think? So Jesus memorializes her selfless act of love. It literally has been talked about ever since. Artists have painted the pictures in many different ways. This is an amazing event for Mary. So I think sometimes it's hard for us. We look at Judas, we look at the disciples, and we're going, what is wrong with you goofballs? Surely you should have seen this. You know, I think that I look at it and I say, you guys have been with Jesus for 3.5 years. You just saw him raise Lazarus from the dead. You heard the words that John the Baptist has spoken about him. We were just down in Jericho. You heard the people that believed. So why aren't you behaving like disciples that know who Jesus is? One thing I've learned, and I guess I'm still learning, that just because people hang out in churches, just because people profess to be Christians, if they're not hanging out with, and sometimes people that literally hang out with Jesus, they own Bibles and all of that kind of stuff, but sometimes they don't act like Christians, honestly, because they ain't a Christian. They're not Christians yet. They say the words, they speak Christianese, they hang out where, you know, Christians hang out. Paul told us that this would happen. Probably he's looking back at this same story going, what was wrong with you guys? Paul, in 1 Corinthians 2:14, he says, the natural man does not receive the things of the Spirit of God. They're foolishness to him. What do we see here? Foolishness. This is a foolish waste. He goes on to say, nor can he know them because they are spiritually discerned. So in other words, a non-believer will never be able to understand the things that us believers are doing. They look at it and say, eh, you right-wing fundamentalist freaks, you know, you guys don't know. They look at those kind of things. Even sometimes, just because a kid is raised in the church does not necessarily mean he's a Christian. I was one of those kind of kids. Comes a time where a person must make that decision. So here we see Judas, no desire. He didn't understand. He had no desire to worship. He became critical. He became judgmental. And Judas, how does his life end? He goes out and hangs himself, literally chokes to death. Interesting, don't you think? So I have noticed that there are some, and I'm sure you guys have noticed it also, there are those that follow Judas with this attitude, with the attitude of, you know, this worship stuff. And listen, worship isn't just singing. It's whatever we do it as unto the Lord. That becomes worship. Can you worship the Lord while you're vacuuming? You bet you can. What about doing laundry? I didn't hear that as convicting. What about folding the laundry? Some of you are saying, don't go any farther than that, Rob, and that'll be good, you know. We can do, if we say, I'm doing this as unto the Lord. I want to bless my family. I want to bless my kids. I want to bless the Lord. So I'm going to do it with that kind of a heart. It becomes worship. Singing praise and worship is another flavor, another style of what worship truly is. But people that follow in the footsteps of Judas, they become critical. They become judgmental. Literally speaking, they get hung up, and it chokes them out, just like Judas did. Okay, that was intentional puns that are supposed to make a point, okay? So, listen, let me tell you one real quick. You can go check it out for yourself, but this always reminds me of that incident. 2 Samuel chapter 6. Remember when David had finally brought the Ark of the Covenant back into Jerusalem. They're carrying it in. They messed up first. Some guys died. This time David goes back, does his homework, figures it out. They come walking in. David takes off his priestly garment, goes out in front of the ark. He's so excited. He's so happy to be bringing the golden box that represents the presence of God back into the city of Jerusalem. He's amazed by this. David breaks out in dance that is a form of his worship. Do you remember? It says he danced before the Lord with all of his might. Now, is it possible to do that as unto the Lord? Yes, but be careful, okay? Be careful, because some of the dancing that I have witnessed is there's no way it can be worship. Okay, so David continues worshiping the Lord, and literally he worshiped the Lord all the days of his life. But one of the wives that he was married to, Michal, a little gift that he got from Saul for killing Goliath, critical. She looks at David and says, oh my goodness, look at what the king's done today. How proud you must be dancing around in your underwear in front of all these people. So her critical attitude was choking her out. She got hung up on what David did. She's looking out there going, oh my gosh, my husband's such a fool. David then says to her, listen, I did what I did as unto the Lord. And so then we see that it's a very interesting thing. David puts Michal away for the rest of her life. She never had a kid. She never got to the joy of bringing forth a child. What does that mean? She was barren for the rest of her life. Have you noticed, have you met those kind of people that will look at you, they will say things of you, oh my goodness, you call that, you know, why do you have to do that as unto the Lord? Why do you have to have such joy in working here? I mean, whatever. Have you ever noticed those people lead barren lives? No joy, no gladness. There's no spice in their life. They just become critical. They literally hang themselves by their own criticalness. It's a sad thing. I've seen it in my own life at times, you know. So I wonder something. I'll throw one last thing for you to think about. I wonder something. Do you understand that in that particular culture, in the Middle East, they didn't take baths or showers every day like we do? You know, do you realize that much of the world doesn't take a shower every day like we do? You know, in Europe, they get them like they take one every 3 or 4 days. Stinking cold over there, that's one reason why. But, you know, they don't do that. I mean, they'll take one every couple of 3 days, and that's it. And so I wonder something here. I wonder if the fragrance of Mary's worship, remember it's 6 days before his crucifixion. The next 6 days, heat up, it goes quick. I wonder if during that 6 day period, Jesus never got an opportunity to take a bath, didn't have showers. I wonder this. So then, on the day of his death, as he was carrying that cross, as he suffered the beating, I wonder if the smell and the fragrance of what Mary had done was still on him and could be smelled even as Jesus was being put to death. I wonder about that one. Because that would be an amazingly beautiful motivation. Mary said, I'm doing this for you, Jesus. Jesus says, I'm doing this for you. Never forget what this smells like, Mary. Never forget what it smells like to be truly worshiping me. And never forget your sacrifice. So this story, that event ends. Now we come to the next day where Jesus rides into Jerusalem, still very fragrant, I guarantee it. So I want to encourage you, as my brothers and my sisters here today, to worship Jesus with the same attitude Mary had. Can I throw that out at you? I talk to people that say, oh my gosh, I hate my job. I hate where I work. Rob, you don't know what it's like. You get to hang around Christian people every day. You don't know what it's like out there in the world. Yeah, I know what it's like out there. Used to work in the world. But if you take that job that you hate and you turn it around to say, Lord, I'm going to do this as unto you. Even the place where you work, where the people are on your back, the people are criticizing you, and you've lost your joy at that place because you stopped doing it as unto the Lord. And you feel it choking you now, just like Judas. Can I encourage you to do something? Whatever you do it heartily as unto the Lord. The place that you work can be a place of worship for you. Where you walk in there and you got the big smile on your face, people say, what are you smiling about? I get to do this as unto the Lord today. Whatever. Shut up. I didn't like you in the first place. You know, as you're doing your household chores, as you're serving in any capacity, if you do it as unto the Lord, it becomes worship. Listen, Jesus has done so much for me, for you, for us. He has done so much for us. Worship him for what he's already done for you. And that means everything of you, every aspect of your life. Say, Lord, this is for you. I'm going to do this as unto you. I'm going to vacuum the car as unto you. I'm going to, you know, clean this house as unto you. I'm going to wash the car as unto you. I'm going to go to work tomorrow as unto you, Lord. Let it be an act of worship. Because as you do, something will happen. Let me tell you what happens. You take on the fragrance of Jesus. You start to smell like him. What did he smell like? Oh, Rob, I don't want to smell like Spartan. No, you take on the attitude. And attitude has a fragrance, doesn't it? Somebody has a bad attitude, we go, that guy's got a stinky attitude. Isn't that interesting? That person, her attitude is foul and disgusting. What does that mean? Bad attitude stinks. The right attitude becomes, and it begins to take on the fragrance of Jesus. And here's what will happen. Not only will you smell like him, listen, when you go home, in your workplace, the environment that you're in, will start to smell like Jesus also. As people watch us, it will take on the fragrance. Just as Simon's house became very fragrant, so will your workplace, so will your home, so will your, when you're watching your kids play soccer or whatever they do, it will begin to take on that same fragrance. So, what do you want it to be said of you? Your attitude stinks. Or, wow, you smell good. What is that? Oh, nothing. No, you, I can smell something. It's Jesus. What do you want to be someone that is identified with? You know what I mean? So even the singing of praise here, do it as unto the Lord and watch what happens. Does that make sense? Jesus, thank you for memorializing Mary and even for Martha, Lord, that we get to see that we can serve, we can teach a Sunday school class, we can change a diaper and it be worship. So today, Lord, I pray that our hearts have been checked, our hearts have been challenged, and that we can look at whatever we're doing and make it an act of worship. Lord, I want to smell like you. I want to take on your fragrance. And so, Lord Jesus, may we do what we do as unto you. In your name we pray, amen.